Welcome to the Short of It on Zeros TV. I'm joined today by Dan David, Freddie Brick, Soren Ondahl, and Carson Block. Gentlemen, thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Carson, I'm under the impression that you've had a bit of a revelation recently.
It's going to get weird. There is a point. So last week, and I guess probably about 3 in the morning, I was almost visited by the prophet himself. Spack Jesus. So I was having this dream that I was in LA and I reached out to him to set up a meeting. I don't know why, but in any event, he didn't show. He sent his assistant to tell me that he would never be meeting with me. And then there were like a few scenes of an LA that doesn't actually exist in the real world. And then I woke up like almost panicked. Because I had this realization, and I don't know what the connection is to Spack Jesus not showing up, but I had this realization that I think interest rates are going to stay where they are basically for the next 1 to 2 to 3 decades. And the reason for that is because we do need to decarbonize the economy, and this is the only way it's going to happen. We have to have a bunch of non-productive, value destructive investments that are going to get us there. Governments obviously cannot allocate capital worth a shit when it comes to science and technology. And look, you know, if the Democrats lose the next election, maybe the Fed will be the last to come along and expressly state that policy is to keep rates that low for the purpose of subsidizing effectively investments in decarbonization. But I think the ECB, BOJ, they'll be there to where it's express policy. And I think the Fed will end up being there too. So, you know, that obviously has ramifications for what we do. I don't think that it means, you know, if I'm correct, I don't think it means that there's no point in being an activist short seller. Maybe quite the opposite. Lots of charlatans will come out of the woodwork. And you know, the way I really think about it is when you look at the successful short activist campaigns of these fake technology companies, like, you know, I mean, we shorted XL Fleet several months ago. Hindenburg has shorted Nikola and Lordstown. It's not about the technology. Like, if you're to be able to do that, you play the man, not the ball. And that's what we as activist short sellers do. We can identify the charlatans. But I think the corollary here, and this is what also kind of my mind was going and I didn't get back to sleep, but I also really started thinking a lot about Elon Musk and his role and kind of where does this fit. I actually think I gained maybe not a full understanding, but a much better understanding of him and why he does what he does. Because, you know, up to this point, I've been super critical of him for the lies and the bullshit and the promotion. I mean, while recognizing that he did legitimately some very impressive, difficult things. But you know, where I think the shorts in Tesla have been wrong, well, where they've been right all along is saying that Tesla needs scale. Otherwise they're gonna be buried by VW and Toyota and GM, Ford, etc. But where they were wrong is that they were thinking of scale only in terms of production capacity or unit sales and not capital base. And that's what Elon's been focused on the whole time, is getting that stock up so that he can have scale of capital base. Today, the company has a $700 billion enterprise value. That's almost double Toyota's. And then when you look at the others, like Ford, GM, I mean, they're around $100 billion. So Tesla has the capital base it needs. It has the scale. You can look at that and say, well, that's fragile, because if reality ever catches up to this thing, then, you know, goodbye market cap. But on the other hand, it's easy to maintain. Like, he doesn't have to sell nearly as many cars as Toyota sells in order to have it. He just has to keep being Elon. So I think that Elon really embodies what the future will look like in terms of the, you know, central banks subsidizing these non-productive or value-destructive investments from the value-destructive from a purely financial standpoint. And what we have to do as short sellers is we have to separate the big charlatans from the Elons. You know, like Elon is a charlatan, but he can build the car, he'll build the rocket. Well, he's done those things. We just have to figure out, you know, it's 95% of the other guys aren't going to be able to do that shit. So that's who we short. So that was a big part of the revelations that I received from the canceled visit by the great prophet himself.
You know, let's take this back all the way to the start, and we don't even need to get into the macro. When you were dreaming about SPAC Jesus, was it top down from that like hunky chiseled, or was it bottom up from the skinny legs?
Well, you know, I think that that's a great metaphor for, you know, SPAC Jesus and his companies. They look great, you know, on the surface.
They all skip leg day. They all skip leg day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd be very interested in hearing what his like upper body workout routine is, but you know, I think I've got him like beat on the leg routine.
I guess, yeah. Elon's probably just like constantly just under the table, just doing that leg machine, just full time working out. I bet that guy's maybe, you know, there's been a lot of work done studying like the length of the index finger, I think, and testosterone in traders. Maybe we should be studying the circumference of either calf or leg muscles for CEOs and just work out if they have been skipping leg day or if it's, you know, if they're the real deal.
Well, I think the retort to that is, if I'm Elon or Chamath, is why don't you measure the circumference of the fuselage of my jet?
Well, before we get too far into phrenology, Carson, you talked about the implications of your realization in terms of the opportunity set getting bigger, as well not recognizing or recognizing that a part of that opportunity set is essentially untouchable. How does the low rate environment affect timing of shorts? I mean, even those charlatans who you said can't build the rocket, can't build the car, they still seem to be able to get away with it longer than maybe they would have been able to in prior cycles. So there are further implications.
Yeah, sure. Well, the thing that I think has been different since the financial crisis about non-activist short selling versus all prior periods during which records were kept is the availability of ultra cheap debt to just keep these things going. And, you know, like we obviously know the smartest short sellers out there, people who are extremely accomplished, do tons of research. And when they lose money, they're generally not wrong in their theses. They're correct. It's just the timing that's become so hard. And I guess you could say that that's really the reason for, I mean, I think when each of us got in this business, it wasn't because we had this macro view and of, you know, you need to create a catalyst, but that's basically what we do. And we're, I mean, there aren't many non-activist short sellers still standing. So I think that's really the issue is it's, I don't see it, obviously in that type of scenario, should I be right? I don't see it being easier at all for non-activist short sellers. And I think that as activist short sellers, like we just have to accept that we live in charlatania basically. And we just have to separate, you know, the major charlatans from the guys who can actually do some shit.
And so when you talk about creating a catalyst, is there any value in actually just waiting for some of this stuff to crack? Like, do you have to take the first punch? Wouldn't it be easier in this world to wait for these things to start being realized and then pounce?
If you want easy, you just go long. I think it's less hard, you know, putting aside the litigation and all the threats and the bullshit attendant with activist short selling. I think it's less hard to do what we do than it is to, you know, to short these things and just hang back.
I mean, look, if I took your advice at face value, we wouldn't have shorted anything over the past 10 years. I mean,
yeah.
It's a long time to wait, just saying.
Yeah, but that's not what he's saying.
I'm more saying like some of the SPACs cracked without any activist research. And then research came out after they had already come down 50%. And those reports, I think, you know, if you look back at that period when the SPACs were cracking, a lot of the research that was coming out was landing. And it was because the market was already starting to realize, and you can play off that momentum. That's more what I was commenting on.
Yeah, I mean, no, you're not wrong. I mean, but you're talking about SPACs necessarily, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I think the SPACs really started to crack because of activist short sellers in general. Just the chatter out there was from the beginning, this is problematic, and we're looking at this, and we will be talking about it soon publicly. And that brought the focus to it, and then others did, Carson and Hindenburg and Soren and others, and, you know, did a great job with it. But, you know, going back 4 or 5 years, there's always that cycle of the Jobs Act IPOs, right, that were kind of what we were looking at, and then it's SPACs, and it's going to be something else.
To give, in terms of SPACs cracking, though, I do think a lot of credit is due to Hindenburg and Nate Anderson, because they came out with that Clover Health, speaking of SPAC Jesus, that Clover Health report right after GameStop and the meme stock things happened. And I think that because Clover Health was actually successful, like it actually did something and was, you know, created, it changed investors' view of the stock.
Shares of Clover Health falling after Hindenburg Research published a critical report on the seller of Medicare-backed insurance plans, calling it a, quote, broken business. Investor Chamath Palihapitiya holds a 27% stake in Clover and brought it public through a SPAC. But importantly, Clover said this morning that it did receive a notice of an SEC investigation and says it intends to fully cooperate. And perhaps more importantly, it acknowledges that Hindenburg's research saying that there is a Department of Justice inquiry taking place and that they're cooperating with that inquiry was in fact true, and something that they did not disclose. They say they did not disclose it at the behest of their lawyers, who said that it would not necessarily be required to be disclosed, arguing that it was not material, but that in fact Chamath Palihapitiya and other investors and people involved in this transaction clearly knew about it as part of the diligence process in advance. Of course, the public did not know about that in advance. They're now saying they didn't have to tell the public about it in advance.
I think that that got a lot of outsized attention at that time on the lack of quality of the SPACs. So, you know, absent that report at that point in time, there might have been less skepticism towards SPACs.
Well, I mean, speaking of Elon and the overall market conditions, I don't know if you guys have read or kept up with the transcript from the SolarCity trial.
And a little bit here and there, yeah.
Yeah. You were joking about racing to enterprise value. One of the funniest things about the transcript is that his cousin admitted under oath that he actually didn't know what enterprise value was, which for a public company CEO is a little bit of a red flag.
I thought he just pretended to be stupid to avoid hard questions. He genuinely is stupid.
Well, in his defense, he thought EV stood for something else, right? I mean,
wait till you ask him about WAC, huh?
Oh man, that's a rap term from the 80s.
Yeah, I think what's fantastic about it, and I don't know if you guys have been following it, but I think the judge is going to find for Elon because of the stock price promotion. But what's clear reading the transcript and what's amazing about it is how levered they were and how close they were with margin calls, because not only were they levered, they had essentially just borrowed on their SolarCity stock, but they had pledged SpaceX cash to buy SolarCity bonds. So if there was a margin call on SolarCity, the potential for a ripple effect throughout the companies was real. And it definitely coincided with some pretty bullish tweets that they were considering acquiring them. But, you know, I think the way the Delaware law shakes out, he's probably going to be okay, just because Tesla's stock appreciated so materially afterwards.
On a human level, that's one of the things that has always impressed me about Elon, is the ability to work with his just entire, like, net worth, complex, the whole thing tied up with such a high level of leverage and need to continuously spin plates for, like, give or take 15 years. I mean, it's pretty insane. I mean, I don't think anyone on this phone call feels any healthier, fitter, or better looking for having been in activist short selling for the best part of 10 years. I'm like, you know, he's kind of been doing something that, you know, has a really high level of stress and execution for a long time. Just the fact that his, like, body hasn't imploded upon itself.
Like the Brendan Fraser meme.
Yeah, it reminds me of almost like a real estate investor who's got 100 properties and, you know, maybe has one property worth of equity and the rest is all bank debt. You know, just
listen, no amount of skill can make up for being very, very lucky.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't think you guys are giving him enough credit. He has an enormous amount of skill. I this is probably a unique hot take among the activist short selling community, but I think I've got a lot of an incredible amount of admiration for the guts that it took to shove all in. You know, I don't know if a lot of us could walk away from $130 million net worth, shove it into two companies, have basically someone tell you that you're going to lose pretty much all of it unless you let either Tesla or SpaceX collapse. And for him to just say, fuck it, that's not the way I'm going out, borrow money to pay your rent and shove into the center. I mean, that's,
yeah,
you gotta have a ton of respect for the amount of just chutzpah that takes.
Being ballsy doesn't make you smart. It makes you ballsy. I mean, like,
yeah, but he's both.
Ballsy at the right time. You're ballsy at the right time until you're ballsy at the wrong time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's actually a real skill in timing and understanding when to, you know, when to swing hard at the pitch. The vast majority of people in life, I don't think, get that right. You know, if they do, it's, you know, once or twice by accident. I've always had a lot of respect for him in terms of the execution, and it's just what bothered me, and I felt there was a stain on his legacy, was the incessant lying. But as I said, I'm not forgiving that, but you know, I get now that it wasn't, you know, when he would engage in these wars with short sellers and like Jim Chanos and Lynette Lopez, I used to think that was only because of his malignant narcissism. I think it's actually because he, you know, in addition to being malignantly narcissistic, he understood this concept of scale of the capital base, and that's what he could achieve and that's what he needed. And the other thing that's also interesting about it is, at times, and I've wondered this myself, is he losing his luster? Is the facade cracking? I mean, when he started, he didn't start Tesla, but when he first got involved with Tesla, like, I think the image was of, he's this humanistic environmentalist and he wants to save the planet. Okay, look, and he built this huge following, but look at him today. No, it's like, you know, he tells OSHA to suck his dick. He tells the SEC to suck his dick. He's got Ted Cruz on his dick. Like, this is a totally different image, and it works. That fan base is just bigger and more devoted than ever. So it's amazing that Elon, you know, who's built really, like I said, the scale of Tesla on, you know, on this image of him, but the image has changed. I mean, that's look, man, there's mastery in that. There's 100%. Intelligence and wisdom. And, you know, what I just said might make it sound like I'm denigrating that. I mean, if I had those powers, I don't know that I would put them to use in that way, but I don't have those powers, man. And very, very few people alive do.
Well, look, this kind of, you know, brings to my mind, speaking of people who can put it all on the line, use a lot of leverage and execute flawlessly, let's talk about Bill Huang, who is none of those things. He's having, it seems like, another bad week. that CS report came out, which was just fucking mind-blowing. It's so hard to read 172 pages of anything, but holy shit, they are so incompetent and stupid. It just blows my mind.
One way to measure this fiasco is by adding up Bill Wong's losses, $20 billion, to the $10 billion that the banks have lost. In total, you've got $30 billion wiped out in the space of a week. Investors on Wall Street lose money all the time. But Archegos is almost unique in financial history because of the size of the positions that a single individual accumulated and the speed with which it unraveled. This is one of the most spectacular failures in modern financial history.
No individual has lost so much money so quickly.
My favorite bit in it all was where they actually posted margin to him in March. That was, for me, the key highlight of how can we fuck this up any worse than it already is. That was insane.
After asking him to post more margin, he was like, no. Can you guys post
two,
more?
Yeah, it was like, how about 2 billion more? Like,
wow. I mean, at one point, it was, he represented risk of 50% of their capital base. This is a guy who had exceeded the newly established exceeded risk limits like 20 plus times in a single year. What the fuck are these guys thinking? And in sum, they made like $17 million in terms of revenue from this account. It's so, so bad on so many levels.
So there's that Bloomberg long form article that just came out on him, kind of. So he's sitting on the porch of his modest house in New Jersey, looking at cars, holding the Christian pamphlet. And that's the thing. I know we've talked about this before, but good God, like, he's still wearing that on his sleeve. Like, it is so phony. It is so fake. It is so contrived. When you're fucking sitting on the porch and holding a Christian pamphlet, having just incinerated $120 billion, you know, and a Bloomberg reporter comes by, like, come on, man.
Oh, you think it's contrived?
I mean,
no, I'm serious. I don't actually think so.
Oh, come on. He put his like Christian foundation on the same floor as his office in 888 7th Avenue. Like, you couldn't find.
Buddy, they had a prayer meeting every Friday before as an office event.
Yeah.
Like, even when things were going well, like, I don't think he's putting this on for the media in order to gain empathy.
Can he quote from the Bible? Yeah. Does he believe in God and Jesus? Yeah. But I think that this was always on his sleeve to make up for, to try to get people to forget the fact that, I mean, he'd been sanctioned about as hard as you can be sanctioned in the financial market, short of an arrest, at least Hong Kong. You know, that was like the Hong Kong version of Steve Cohen's fine, I think. He's trying to get into Goldman Sachs and he wants to get the SEC to repeal the ban so that he can run outside capital. To me, this was all contrived, like displaying, putting the foundation on the same floor. And even to this day, when he's clearly one of the most egomaniacal motherfuckers of our age, to have incinerated $20 billion of his own capital in days, you know, running 5-to-1, 6-to-1 leverage, he's sitting there on the porch with your Christian pamphlet? Bullshit, dude. That's sociopathy. That is contrived. And I don't know. But it always works, right? Like, it always works.
But I think you guys have it the opposite. I think that actually it's not contrived. And the reason that he's able to behave the way he is because he so firmly believes that it's divine inspiration. I mean, they've done this really interesting study of, I forgot who is the author, It was an economics PhD, so no one remembers his name, obviously. But it was giving study participants the it was essentially a lie test on dice that were covered. You had to tell the results of the experiment. You basically had to tell the experimenter what your results were, and you could get paid a certain amount if your results were better. And what they found was that they basically established a baseline for lying. But when they told people that the proceeds would go to charity, the amount of lies and the amount and the frequency and the degree to which people lie when they believe they were doing it for a good cause vastly exceeded when they were doing it for themselves. So I think that in the case of Bill Wang, it makes total sense because he's not on a jet into Mykonos, like pouring Dom Perignon off on like 20 Instagram models or OnlyFans, whatever. He's living in a house in Jersey, shoveling as much into Christian organizations as he can. I think you only do that because it's not contrived, because you firmly believe that the divinity and the investment are essentially unified.
But, or that you secretly were jetting off to the Caribbean,
right,
to pour Dom on hookers, and
Whoa.
Not accusing him of that, of paying for sex.
They're not hookers, guys.
When you're that wealthy, you don't actually have to hand the money over.
Okay. And it's Chris Paul. So.
Well, she didn't claim to be divine, but many of the similarities are there. I know, Soren, you're tracking the Elizabeth Holmes trial and all of the developments there.
Yeah, I mean, a really fascinating development happened this week, which was she's tried very hard to get patient testimony excluded from the trial as evidence that's admissible. The judge ruled against her, and he did so. I think one of the wrinkle here that's so interesting is Theranos handed over the government a database. When the government raided their offices, they said, you have to produce all of the evidence, including all the patient data and trials. Theranos put it all on a drive, handed it to the government, did not give the government the password to the drive, and then proceeded to delete all the information in the original source. And then when the government said 3 years later, hey, we can't open this file, Theranos said, well, unfortunately, we lost the password. And Theranos tried to get the judge to rule that all of the patient results should be excluded because they couldn't unlock the drive. And the government said, well, wait a minute, you were the ones who deleted the evidence. And the judge agreed with them. But I think what's amazing about that wrinkle is just the confidence it takes to hand the government a drive, delete it, and also knowing that the investigators aren't going to try and open it for the next like 2.5 years. Like, it would seem to be like the first thing that you do when you get it. But the judge looked askance at her attorney's decisions and her desire to have that suppressed, and they ruled against her, which I think the government has to think is a pretty good development for them.
Right, because isn't one of the witnesses who did or who's going to testify a woman who had some miscarriages due to, yeah, I think, yeah, the fetus is having genetic birth defects, or, well, I guess they weren't birth defects, but genetic issues, and she got the test from Theranos, and did she decide to terminate the pregnancy based on...
I don't think she decided to terminate it, but I mean, look, Theranos was telling people they had AIDS when they didn't, and or HIV, and then they would, you know, have to go to their sexual partners and have those conversations when those things were false. Like, that's...
Yeah, but
you know, the harm is real there.
Was that a problem for Bill Wang?
I'm also saying no wonder Mark's so pissed.
Think about how good it must have felt after to call and just say, hey, it turns out that wasn't true. I mean, think about the goodwill that can create if you had have had a bad breakup. Not to trivialize the condition, but it's not all bad, guys. If you could just be a little bit more sunny here, a little bit looking in the
right side.
I don't
think you get to walk that back, do you?
I don't know. Ready? What's that like?
Soren, you brought up an interesting bit about the juxtaposition between how the case with Elizabeth Holmes is being handled and how the case with Elon Musk and SolarCity is being handled. I mean, they're completely different sorts of cases, but it seems like Elizabeth Holmes is getting the full force of the government, whereas Elon Musk is kind of getting the benefit of the doubt, and partially because there are victims on the side of Elizabeth Holmes, and there aren't really victims on the side of the SolarCity lawsuit. Is that what differentiates?
No, I think no way. I mean, it's to me, they're not analogous. Like, she deserves the full might of the federal government thrown against her. I mean, if it is that, the level of brazenness and the not just the number of people, even if no patient had ever been tested, the brazenness of the lies to investors, which I actually think is how the government's really going to win the case, it's just on a level that we haven't really seen other places in the capital market. So I don't think that's a fair comparison. I think it's pretty different.
A question for the panel. What do you think the accountability or liability with the independent board of directors should be? I mean, because currently it's none.
Up to the maximum of their insurance coverage?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But no personal accountability for the independent board of directors of this company or any other that are ostensibly supposed to be there representing the shareholders and their interests.
Yeah, on this topic of direct insurance, I did see, I think it might have been Michael Saylor has personally provided insurance to his board of directors, which, and I might be incorrect on that, but I did remember reading it a couple weeks ago, and I think you can kind of look at that both ways. He's either like absolutely sure that they're not putting stupid stuff on email and it's bulletproof, or there is no other way for him to get insurance and keep the charade going. So it's a very all-in strategy that.
Well, I mean, Elon has to personally indemnify the Tesla directors. They can't get D&O. Mm. You
know, Freddie, why do you think? So you think he's personally underwriting all the policies? Like, he just has to indemnify?
Yeah, I'm fairly certain. I saw it the other week that he's also personally underwriting. I want to say it was like up to $60 million. I'll have to come back on that, but it was a real number.
That's, I mean, that, like, them bail. What kind of margin do you get on that?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, keep in mind, this is a guy who raises debt to keep buying Bitcoin. So risk management, maybe not a thing that he's particularly fond of. But it's worked.
That seems to be the difference, is whether it works or whether it doesn't. And that's kind of, Carson, to bring it full circle, what you were talking about. There will be people who blur the lines, but that's the difference between a true charlatan and somebody who is kind of untouchable. Well, it works.
From a shorting perspective, I think that's what matters. You know, why is Elon untouchable as far as the law goes? I think it's the iconic status, which is based on him actually making shit that works. So, I mean, Elizabeth Holmes, well, I mean, was not iconic. She was maybe on her way somewhat, but nobody could actually end up buying that box and putting it in their homes. Whereas lots of people got Teslas. I mean, they, you know, and I've heard from Tesla owners who love the car. So it's, I think that's the difference in terms of what the way the SEC or the DOJ would approach it is, you know, Elon, a lot of people believe Elon's saving Earth from us, and he's actually produced, you know, things that kind of evidence that to some extent.
Yeah, but that, you know, if Elizabeth Holmes had have allowed us to each get a device in home, and you had a terrible venereal disease and you got the wrong results, there would have been a lot of people who liked those results. So, you know, that, I just think if it had gone a little bit further.
Well, I don't know. You know, most venereal diseases are only moderately bad, not terrible, so.
Right, but the people with them getting the incorrect results would have been really pumped.
Speaking of venereal disease, Dan, how are you doing?
The test results came in. I still have it.
Yeah.
How about you guys just congratulate me for my 3 short calls being down an average of 50% this year?
Before we wrap up, We need to congratulate Dan David of Wolfpack for 3 short calls this year that are down on average 50%. Did I have that correct, Dan?
No, it's over 50%.
Over 50%.
Yeah.
Holy
shit.
What's going to especially impress our viewers is because he's done that with inside of a year, Dan's now going to do the math in his head to annualize that return for you.
Carl?
All right, guys. Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the Short of It. Looking forward to doing it again soon.